John Huckenberry here with Catherine Lamfer. At 9 p.m. last night, police swept in and arrested four men allegedly involved in a plot to bomb two synagogues in New York City. Officials said the men had actually planted bombs, or what they thought were bombs, and were looking for the capability to shoot down military planes in Newburgh, New York. This morning, Mayor Bloomberg, after a night of anxiety for people in Newburgh and the Bronx, was all about reassurance.
To me, I come out of this feeling more confident than ever before, that when there is something, the police department discovers it and stops it.
As we said, four men are in custody. They will be arraigned in White Plains, New York, later on this morning. But what was the detail of the plots? Well, they're beginning to leak out. Here's a spokesman for the FBI.
They have bags that were set up, they believe, to be bombs carrying about 30 pounds of explosives, what they believe to be explosives. Here we had vehicles staged by us, by the Joint Terrorism Task Force. They would place a satchel or a bag in a vehicle in front of the temple down the block, and then two more bags into a vehicle parked in front of the synagogue here.
Talking about the fake explosives, Joseph Demarest, assistant director in charge of the FBI's New York division, talking about the fake explosives that were picked up as part of the arrest when police swooped in and brought four men into custody. As I mentioned, they will be arraigned at 1 p.m. this afternoon in White Plains, New York. Joining us now, Bob Henley, WNYC reporter, who's been following this story since the beginning. Bob, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
And Bruce Hoffman, terrorism expert at Georgetown University. Bob Henley, first of all, where do we stand? What's likely to come up at the arraignment at 1 later today?
Well, certainly details about their age, and we'll begin to see some kind of the government will put out more of their hand. One of the things that's already emerging is this goes back to June 2008, an experienced confidential informant, six-year history with the FBI, was evidently trolling around a mosque in Newburgh, New York, Orange County, that's 60 miles of New York City, a kind of exurban place, but you can still find cows up there. It's in close proximity to Stewart Air Force Base, which was a major transit point for the U.S. military to get supplies to Afghanistan and Iraq. And this confidential informant basically came forward, went to the FBI, and then for, over a year now, pretty much gave these four individuals, James Cromite, David Williams, Unta Williams, and Laguerre-Pien, the sense that he had access to weaponry and to the kind of things they'd need to pull off this simultaneous plot, pretty bold, actually, to try to bomb two synagogues in Riverdale and also take out U.S. military aircraft at Newburgh.
All right, Bruce, three of the men are apparently American citizens here. Before we talk about the investigative techniques and how the FBI followed this organization, is this a disturbing example of potentially homegrown terrorism here, Bruce?
I think it's a disturbing example of radicalization in that you have individuals that were clearly looking to commit some act of terrorism. And as Bob was saying, we're trawling around, you know, this mosque, or at least soliciting information on how to obtain the weapons. Certainly, also, I think the reconnaissance involved in this shows that they were quite serious, because these two synagogues in the Riverdale section of the Bronx, one's on 237th Street, one's on 246th Street, I mean, you would only know that by, in other words, actively surveilling what likely targets would be. So I think we have to take this quite seriously.
Unless the confidential informant was the one who came up with the targets, and we don't know that. Bruce first, and then Bob. Bruce?
Oh, my understanding is that it was not who had come up with the targets. My only point is that this had gotten to the point of actually
right. The
terrorists believed they were going to execute a plot and had selected targets, so it meant they had done their homework.
Bob, the complaint describes the role of the confidential informant here. How much precedent is there for this kind of use of a confidential informant?
Very strong in the United States. I mean, the government has had success here making these cases. What ends up happening, there are usually a couple of days in a full-blown jury trial where the confidential informant's credibility is on the line. So the degree to which the individual has a criminal past, or it becomes, if it looks like he is egged on the people that were participating, then the government takes a hit. In England, it looks like there's a little bit of terror fatigue there. They haven't been as successful of late making these cases. The central question here, though, is that it looks like the government let this plot go farther than usual in the sense that these individuals last night, according to the government, really thought they were doing something and took major overt actions. The other thing that hasn't really been discussed is the government evidently let them buy a 9mm handgun in Brooklyn back in April. And so that certainly added a level of edginess here. And I might add that ESU was in full body armor yesterday when they took these guys out.
So what's ESU? What's ESU?
Emergency Service Unit, which is the top NYPD forces that deal with this kind of thing. I guess the government has this constant balancing act between if they do it too soon, then they look like nothing was really going to happen. If they let it go too far, there's a chance that someone could get hurt. And that's a tough balancing act.
Bruce, all right, I'm a resident of Riverdale this morning, all right? Just let's pretend, okay? Mayor Bloomberg is saying there was no threat here, absolutely no threat here, absolutely no threat here. The rabbi in my community is saying there was a threat. We have to be very, very concerned this morning. Which is it? Am I more nervous this morning or less nervous this morning, depending on how this played out?
Well, there certainly was the threat of that, there's no doubt, because there was a plot to attack the two synagogues. I think the question is, as Bob just described, is how far the authorities let the plot unfold, in other words, to get them caught red-handed, as it were, to have a case that would be rock solid in court, at least that they were in the process of committing the crime. But there, at least my understanding, is that New York City police and FBI and Joint Terrorism Task Force personnel were there to control the incident. So whatever possibility there might have been of something going awry seems to have been very closely anticipated and very tightly controlled.
Hey, Bruce, I want to talk about, you know, remember the Lackawanna Six? We had a case where there was all this attention. Everyone said, oh, we're safer now. We foiled this. And then it petered out a bit when it actually hit the legal system.
Well, again, and I this is why I think this plot was allowed to proceed as far as it did, and why the perpetrators were, you know, at least under the assumption that they were in the process of committing an actual terrorist attack, and it's for that reason to secure convictions. But I think the problem is, too, it's not just the Lackawanna Six. We've had the Fort Dix plot last year when you had a group of individuals that once again sought out someone with access to weaponry, someone with access to training, but had never gotten as far as actually going through the motions of believing that they were perpetrating a terrorist act. And, of course, then there's a different comfort level once charges are brought against them in court, whether a conviction can be secured.
Although, Bob, it sounds like what Bruce is saying, that a pattern is developing here where prosecutors and investigators basically have to encourage these kind of keystone cop terrorist types who have strong intent but little availability to impress a judge. And in the course of that, they end up terrifying communities.
It dials back to our basic premise of the war on terrorism was that we're fighting them over there so they don't come here. In point of fact, we may be actually proliferating these homegrown terrorism things because of the global nature of information. Clearly in the complaint, these individuals that are being charged here, we're seeing the pictures of the civilian deaths that the U.S. military has conceded has happened as collateral damage in Afghanistan and Iraq, and they have made a moral equivalency, right or wrong, between the civilian deaths there at the hands of the U.S. military and what they think needs to happen here. And so that social alienation is troubling. The fact that people, that this war on terror was predicated on, that we could keep that over there, the containment's not working if we're talking about alienation being the thing we're concerned about.
Bruce Hoffman, I'll give you the last word here. Are these tactics, as you're seeing them in the complaint, a sign that the FBI is on top of things or that they're needing convictions to develop a track record?
No, my view would be that they're on top of things. I mean, society can't demand of our authorities that they preempt and prevent terrorist attacks if we're not going to give them the tools and the means to do so.
And the tools and means in this particular case involve helping this plot unfold to the point where a judge sees that these individuals plant the bombs?
No, I would interpret it differently. I would say it's the use of an informant to detect a terrorist plot and to derail it, but then to ensure that the evidence is sufficient in a very controlled circumstance, which, at least according to reports, this seems to have been, in order to secure a conviction. and not just the conviction of those individuals, but to send a powerful message to other would-be radicals in the United States that we're prepared and that we're able to derail their attacks and identify them.
Bruce Hoffman, terrorism expert at Georgetown University. Bob Henley, WNYC reporter. One other detail I want to give you. All these men apparently had links to Afghanistan, and the term Jaish-e-Mohammed, a Pakistani terrorist group, was named in the complaint, although so far no links to Pakistan. All the details later on this morning. Bob and Bruce, thanks so much.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.